Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're really thrilled you're here with us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Because if you're listening to this, you're probably the kind of person who loves to peel back the layers of history, you know, look past those dry textbook summaries and find the real beating heart of a story.
Human element.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is exactly our mission for today's Deep Dive. We are unpacking a genuinely fascinating stack of primary source excerpts from late 1915.
Which is just an incredible period to look at.
It really is. I mean, we are talking about literal history in the present tense here. Newspapers, private letters, military dispatches written right in the thick of World War I.
Right, as it was happening.
Right. But we aren't going to be focusing on the grand strategy or the politics or, you know, the movement of massive armies on a map.
We're zoomed in.
We are zooming way in. We are going to explore the stark realities of this conflict, the gritty day-to-day life of the soldiers down in the trenches, and the dramatic and honestly often surprising ripple effects echoing back on the home front.
And it is such a crucial perspective to take, especially when you consider the sheer, almost incomprehensible scale of the conflict we're looking at through these documents.
It's hard to even wrap your head around it.
It really is. I mean, to give you an idea of what these people were dealing with on a logistical level, one of our late 1915 dispatches notes that a single German army corps at that time consisted of 41,000 men.
41,000.
In just one corps. And when they were on the march, that single corps stretched out into a procession 15 miles long.
15 miles of just marching men.
Just picture that for a second. When you have a conflict of that unimaginable magnitude, it stops being just a war fought between professional armies on some distant battlefield.
It becomes something else entirely.
Right. It becomes a total war. It required a complete rewiring of global society, pulling every single resource, every industry, and literally every civilian into its orbit.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because the way these massive global shifts trickle down to the individual soldier is incredibly striking.
It really redefines the human experience.
Let's start right in the mud of the front lines. Reading through these firsthand accounts, I was entirely expecting to hear about the dominance of massive artillery or the new machine guns.
The big technological terrors.
Exactly. But there is this recurring detail that just stands out. Next to his rifle, the soldier's most prized possession wasn't a weapon at all.
No, it wasn't.
It was the entrenching tool. We're talking about a tiny, simple pick and spade. Why was that little shovel the most important thing a soldier carried?
Because it represented a massive paradigm shift in human history. The psychology behind the entrenching tool is absolutely primal, but it also marks the death of romanticized combat.
The end of the glorious cavalry charge.
Exactly. These 1915 sources describe how when a soldier had to discard almost every other piece of heavy equipment on an exhausting march just to keep moving, he would stubbornly cling to that little spade.
Over food, over extra clothes.
Survival in this newly mechanized, industrialized warfare dictated digging cover the absolute second in advance was over. The instinct to dig in became so overpowering that it conquered every other human drive.
It overrode basic biology.
It did. The accounts tell us that after fighting for 10 or 12 hours straight, when a soldier was so physically depleted that the need for sleep or food felt entirely superfluous, they would still spend from dusk to midnight desperately scraping a hole in the earth.
Just digging a hole.
Their only thought was getting below ground level before the dawn brought the artillery.
It was literally a matter of life and death. And these dispatches give a pretty harrowing example of what happened when soldiers didn't respect that new reality, right?
Yeah, they do.
There's a mention of a cavalry regiment near Mons that completely refused to dig in.
This is a perfect example. The text points out that they had what it calls foolish ideas of caste.
Foolish ideas of caste. Wow.
These men were clinging to a 19th century mindset in a 20th century war. They felt that digging in the dirt was beneath them.
That it was infantry work.
Yeah. Right. A manual labor simply not suitable for proud, elite cavalrymen. Mm. So when they were rushed into a gap to cover a flank, they just sat above ground.
Just sat there on their horses.
Pretty much. And the tragic result is recorded incredibly plainly in the dispatches. A German battery found them, and in just 10 minutes, the entire regiment was wiped out.
10 minutes.
The dispatch says the artillery sprayed them like a gardener watering a bush. It's a brutal illustration of how the mechanized nature of this war instantly punished any adherence to the old romantic ideals of standing tall on a battlefield.
It's terrifying, but what's so compelling is that even in the face of that relentless mechanization, The human element, the sheer audacity of individual soldiers, still managed to shine through.
Absolutely. The individual acts of bravery are staggering.
There is this unbelievable story in the stack about a Lieutenant W. Cooper, who was apparently an amateur footballer from England before the war.
Just a regular guy.
Just a guy who plays soccer. And this guy painstakingly tunneled 192 yards underground by hand. He accidentally breaks into a German mine. And while under fire, he and his men manage to steal over a ton of their high explosives.
Hauling all of that back through a narrow tunnel is just staggering.
And then you have the bomb-throwing squads. The dispatches mention that soldiers actually requested to be assigned as bombers.
Which sounds completely counterintuitive.
Right. They wanted that job because it put them right up front, despite the insane danger of chucking explosives around the sharp, zigzag corners of the trenches.
The traverses.
Yeah, the traverses, hoping to clear them before the enemy could check a grenade back.
That kind of localized, intimate bravery really is astonishing, especially when you contrast it with the terrifying, impersonal scale of the new weapons they were facing every day.
The artillery you mentioned earlier.
Right. The psychological toll of the constant bombardment must have been staggering. The sources detail the effects of the massive 42-centimeter mortar shells.
42 centimeters. That's huge.
It's massive. We are talking about a weapon that held a kill radius of 150 yards from its impact point.
150 yards.
The shockwaves were so intensely powerful that they could magnetize the barrels of the soldiers' rifles.
That is insane.
They could make men simply disappear into the earth. To maintain any semblance of fighting spirit, let alone volunteer for a bombing squad, under a sky raining down that kind of indiscriminate destruction requires a level of mental endurance that is very hard for us to fully grasp today.
Which naturally leads you to wonder, how on earth did they cope with that?
You have to find a way to ground yourself.
Exactly. Imagine yourself stuck in that trench, freezing, surrounded by mud, and living under the constant threat of those mortars. What would you want to bring you comfort?
It's the small things.
It really is. One of the most touching details in these 1915 papers is about a young university student at the front. He wrote a letter home, and out of everything he could have possibly asked for, he just wanted two things.
What were they?
A weekly copy of a literary magazine called The Spectator and a small tin of insect powder. He just wanted a tiny slice of his intellectual life from before the war and a bit of relief from the lice.
What's fascinating here is how vital those seemingly small comforts were as psychological anchors.
Anchors to who they used to be.
Yes. In an environment that was systematically designed to strip away their humanity and turn them into interchangeable cogs in a military machine, a literary magazine or a simple cigarette was a tether to their past selves.
Speaking of cigarettes, you see these massive community efforts back home, too. Like the Canadian Tobacco Fund.
Raising money purely to send smokes.
Right. To men who were sleeping on wet straw in the freezing mud without even a blanket.
It reminded them that they were individuals, that someone cared. And we see this desperate need for connection and normalcy manifesting in other ways throughout these documents, too.
Yes. The animal mascots.
The animals are such a great detail.
One of the most striking things in this stack of papers was how these hardened men found comfort in animals. You have troops adopting anything they could find to bring some lightness into the dark.
What kind of animal?
Well, there was a regiment that adopted a stray cat as a mascot. The dispatch says one day the cat disappears and the men are absolutely devastated.
I bet.
But then it comes slowly crawling back into the camp, purring, holding a dead bird in its mouth.
Just doing regular cat things in the middle of a war zone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The soldiers respected that cat so much, they considered it their most prized possession next to their actual regimental colors.
That is amazing.
And then there was the English dog that just decided it belonged to the Lancashire regiment. It followed them everywhere on the march.
Loyal to the end.
It even survived being run over by a motor car, just popping back up to keep marching with the men.
Those animal companions provided a purely innocent, non-judgmental affection that must have been incredibly grounding for men surrounded by violence.
Something normal to hold on to.
It really is a testament to the sheer willpower of the human spirit to find some semblance of normalcy and connection in the abyss.
And that willpower, that drive to serve and survive, wasn't just found in the young men in the trenches either.
No, the compulsion to participate in this struggle transcended age and background. One source mentions a 70-year-old French volunteer who was discovered fighting highly efficiently right in the first line of defense.
70 years old in the front line.
It proves that this war pulled everyone in.
Speaking of that immense human spirit, we really need to talk about the medical care.
That's a huge part of these sources.
Because what happened when that survival instinct met the reality of severe injury or capture is a whole other story. There's a detail in the letters that just stopped me in my tracks.
About the hospitals?
Yeah. It's about these French-Canadian soldiers who were recovering in English hospitals. They were completely isolated because they didn't speak a word of English, and the local nurses couldn't speak French.
That must have been terrifying.
One soldier, lying in a hospital bed with a shattered right arm, managed to write a letter home using his left hand.
Wow.
And all he said was, "All that I need is that you write to me again. If only I were with you, we could talk together."
Oh, man.
Just imagine that profound, quiet loneliness amidst a crowded hospital ward.
It is incredibly moving. It highlights the completely unforeseen logistical and emotional challenges of moving diverse colonial troops across the globe.
Just the language barrier alone.
But it is also worth noting how communities responded to that isolation. Ladies from the Quebec Red Cross actually organized to write letters in French to these specific soldiers just to give them someone to communicate with.
That is a beautiful response.
Yeah.
And on a broader scale, the sheer size of the medical infrastructure that was built almost overnight is staggering. The hospitals they set up were massive.
The sources describe the number one general Canadian hospital in Boulogne. They had pristine, cutting-edge X-ray equipment that rivaled anything in London or Montreal.
Right near the front lines.
The logistics were so advanced, they were using massive mechanical cranes to gently lower chair-bound convalescent soldiers from the high decks of hospital ships down to the smaller launches.
It's industrial-scale healing to match the industrial-scale destruction.
Exactly. And the bravery of the medical staff was unmatched. The sources highlight Captain Scrimger, a medical officer who won the Victoria Cross for treating the wounded out in the open under an absolute storm of artillery shells.
Incredible heroism. But if you didn't end up in a hospital and you were captured, the reality was pretty grim.
The POW camps were brutal.
We have the account of Private James Law of the Scots Guards, who spent 8 months as a prisoner in Germany. His description of daily life is incredibly rough.
Forced labor, right.
Yeah. Men who were already weak from hunger were used as draft animals, literally pulling heavy plows and barrows through the fields. And the food, he said he wouldn't feed it to pigs back in Scotland.
What are they eating?
They were given this soft, damp, putty-like bread made out of potatoes, bran, and oil cake.
Oil cake?
It's basically the compressed leftover residue of seeds that is usually fed to livestock.
That sounds awful.
And for soup, it was a watery mixture of raw herring scales, entrails, eyes, and all just tossed into a bucket and boiled.
It is a harrowing picture of captivity and sensory deprivation.
It really is.
However, our sources also provide a really unique counter perspective from the other side of the wire.
Oh, right. The German correspondent.
Yes. And it's always fascinating to read accounts from the opposing side. Now, we're not endorsing their broader worldview or taking sides here, but it gives us a rare window into how these bitter enemies actually viewed each other face to face.
Impartially reporting what the source says.
Exactly. A German correspondent named Bernhard Kellermann was observing newly captured British soldiers in Flanders. His observation is remarkable for its tone.
He wasn't gloating.
Not at all. Instead of gloating over a defeated enemy, he expresses a deep respect for them. He notes that these British soldiers had been sitting in the mud for weeks, yet the moment they were captured, they took out their pocket knives and meticulously scraped the crusted mud off their puttees.
Those are the long strips of cloth they wrapped tightly around their lower legs to keep the damp out, right?
Yes. He wrote that they marched into captivity with the elastic step of athletes, maintaining their dignity and proving that dirt and slovenliness were hateful to them.
That image of holding on to your humanity and your pride in a prison camp is powerful.
Very powerful.
But that same struggle to maintain normalcy and adapt to massive disruption was happening thousands of miles away from the front line, too. The war was fundamentally rewriting the rules for civilians.
The home front was unrecognizable.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because while the soldiers were fighting to survive, the line between the military and the home front basically vanished.
Total war means everyone is involved.
To give you an idea of how strict things got, there is a story of a young man working on a civilian patrol boat. His only job was to obey the military blackout rules.
Which were very strict.
Extremely. One night, he goes into his cabin to undress and just flicks on the electric light for a fraction of a second. The commander dismissed him the very next day, just for turning on a light bulb.
That's intense.
It shows how total military discipline was bleeding into everyday civilian contracts and lives.
The phrase total mobilization is not an exaggeration. The labor shortage caused by millions of men going to the trenches created a vacuum that fundamentally altered society.
Because someone still had to do the work.
Exactly. The most profound shift was the massive entry of women into the workforce. The sources note how women took over the heavy, highly dangerous work in munitions factories, handling toxic chemicals and explosives.
That's a huge shift in gender roles.
And it wasn't just industrial labor. One article excitedly reports that over 200 women invaded the Bank of England to work as clerks.
The Bank of England. That must have been a very stuffy, male-dominated place.
A highly conservative financial institution that had never employed women in clerical roles before. And they were working grueling 12-hour days to keep the economy afloat.
And because all these women were suddenly taking these higher-paying essential jobs, the entire domestic labor market flipped upside down.
Right. The servants were leaving.
Housewives in London were panicking because domestic servants became so extraordinarily scarce that registry offices were quoting wages of $100 to $125 just to attract young women.
Which was an absolute fortune at the time.
An absolute fortune. Young women who previously would have had no other economic options whatsoever were suddenly in high demand.
It completely upended the class and economic structures of the time. And we see massive social shifts happening in other countries as well, often with huge unintended consequences.
Like in Russia.
Yes. In Russia, for example, the government enacted a total ban on the sale of vodka to ensure a sober military and workforce.
A wartime prohibition.
But the sudden prohibition had a surprisingly rapid economic effect on the peasantry. Because the money that was previously wasted in spirit shops was now staying in their pockets, the sources report that Russian peasants suddenly had actual savings.
That is wild.
They were shifting their spending entirely. They were buying meat to eat daily, purchasing decent clothes, and acquiring new farming utensils.
It essentially injected massive capital into the agrarian economy overnight, simply by removing alcohol from the equation.
Exactly.
It's wild to think of a wartime prohibition sparking an agricultural economic boom.
Oh.
But governments were regulating everything, trying to control civilian behavior to support the war effort.
London had its own rules, too.
Yeah, in London, they passed a no-treating law in the pubs.
No treating.
You legally couldn't buy a round of drinks for your friends anymore.
You had to buy your own.
Right. And the sources specifically mentioned this was aimed at curbing drinking among lower-class women, whose entire social lives revolved around the pub.
The logic being what?
The logic was that if a woman had to drink alone and pay for herself, she would be viewed as greedy and unsocial, which the government hoped would keep her out of the pub entirely and focused on work.
It was a time of intense social engineering driven by sheer desperation.
Desperation is the right word.
Right. But the desperation wasn't just about managing public behavior. It was about basic daily survival. The civilian toll was incredibly severe, particularly in Germany, due to the blockades.
The food shortages.
We have reports from the working-class Wedding City district of Berlin describing horrific food riots. Women were gathering at 5 in the morning, waiting the livelong night in the freezing cold just for the chance to buy basic cooking fats and lard.
Waiting all night in the cold just for lard.
The crowds were so dense and the wait so physically grueling that hundreds of women were collapsing and fainting right on the pavement.
That is so bleak.
When the doors finally opened, the stampede was described as moving like a wild mountain torrent, crushing people against the walls.
It paints such a vivid, terrifying picture of what the families of those soldiers were enduring back home. The war was literally starving them.
It touched every aspect of life.
But despite all of this suffering, the food riots, the unimaginable casualties, the POW camps people were already looking ahead.
Planning for the future.
Even in the absolute thick of the fighting in 1915, they were planning for the aftermath. There are accounts in these papers of governments realizing they had a massive responsibility to take care of the permanently disabled.
They had never seen so many wounded returning home.
The mayor of Lyon in France was already establishing specialized trade schools, specifically to teach new, sustainable skills to soldiers who had suffered amputations.
Retraining the workforce.
And they were drawing up extensive community farming schemes, planning to provide state credit and expert agricultural instructors so returning veterans could settle on the land and support themselves.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it becomes clear that the primary sources we are looking at today prove that World War I was not just a clash of opposing armies in a field.
It was so much more than that.
It was the violent, chaotic collision of entire societies. The front line and the home front merged into a single massive machine.
The state was forced to take on responsibilities it had never assumed before.
Exactly. Managing the national food supply, directing labor markets, enforcing public morality, and planning for the long-term welfare and retraining of its disabled citizens.
So what does this all mean for you and me sitting here today reading these century-old documents?
It's about resilience.
When you read these primary sources, the thing that echoes loudest isn't the sound of the artillery. It is the unbelievable resilience of the people involved.
You see it everywhere in the text.
You see it in the British soldier using a pocket knife to meticulously scrape the mud off his uniform in a freezing prisoner of war camp just to maintain his dignity.
You see it in the women working 12-hour shifts at the Bank of England to keep the global economy from collapsing.
And you see it in the young university kid asking for his favorite magazine amidst the unimaginable horror of the trenches.
That resilience is absolutely the thread that ties all these disparate accounts together. It is the human capacity to adapt to the unimaginable, to dig a trench when you are dead on your feet and still try to build something better for tomorrow.
Exactly. And that brings us to a final thought for you to mull over as you go about your day.
We've covered a lot of ground today.
We've talked extensively about how total mobilization required a complete rewiring of society, pulling women into high-level financial and industrial work, having the state manage the diets of its citizens, and forcing massive wealth redistribution in places like Russia.
All born out of wartime necessity.
Consider this. How much of our modern peacetime society was actually forged in the absolute worst conditions of 1915?
That's a great question.
These desperate necessities accidentally laid the groundwork for the modern social safety nets and labor rights we take for granted today. Once a society has been totally mobilized, once class lines and gender roles have been thoroughly blurred in the mud and the munitions factories, can you ever really go back to the way things were?
You really can't. The world was changed forever.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.